brave.
When it comes to discussing our bodies, we often get a little uncomfortable. Women's health issues are often seen as off-limits. Taboo topics we just don't talk about. It's time for that to change. Let's talk. Welcome to the Brave Mama podcast, where we are going to do exactly that. Discuss everything, from periods to pregnancy, motherhood to menopause. No topic is off-limits. Join Stephanie Thompson, the Brave Mama and author of The Day My Vagina Broke, as she asks other brave women about their personal health challenges and triumphs. You will learn, laugh, and cry as Stephanie finds out everything you wanted to know but were too afraid or embarrassed to ask. So, grab a cuppa and enjoy.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of The Lowdown with Brave Mama. It is Steph Thompson, your host here, and today's conversation is going to be really helpful for you or potentially someone that you know who has had a birthing experience that did not go to plan. We could call that a traumatic birth experience, but to me, trauma is in the eye of the person who had the experience. So some people have had their baby and have come out the other side and thought no different. Whereas some people have gone in and what would be a textbook, relatively straightforward birth, can be left really traumatized. And so we don't define what trauma looks like in this childbirth space because it is up to the person who has been through the experience. Today, April Hagen is bringing you her journey that talks about her trauma for about a split second. And the reason why I'm sharing this with you is because she talks a lot about what happened next. And I think that's important too, how women can work through this space, seek appropriate help and support to come out the other end and then be able to share what they can do now or what she does do now. What I think you're going to love the most is that after her experience and living with pelvic organ prolapse, despite living with pelvic organ prolapse, she has still created an amazing business that started as a simple side hustle on something that she just loved doing. She loves interior design. She's worked in the industry. She also discovered that she liked social media and was bloody good at it. And so now she's created this amazing business for herself where prolapse is not the center of her universe, but her life, her career, and now back on track. So if this is you and you've been through a birthing experience that was traumatic, you've been left with pelvic organ prolapse or other injuries, and you are looking for some hope, for some light at the end of the tunnel, you're going to need to listen to this episode with April. And if you are new here and you haven't had an opportunity to get the full picture, I'm going to suggest that you go back to season one and listen to an episode with Dr. Elizabeth Skinner. She was a founding member of the Australasian Birth Trauma Association. And seeing as it's Birth Trauma Awareness Week from July 17 to the 24th, I think it will help you get more insight as to where we have been as a community on this journey and where we are now. I think I've shared over the last few episodes that this is where the direction of this podcast is going. We are going to be talking to more mums and more women who have been through an experience where they've had prolapse or still have prolapse and are able to continue to live a fulfilling life. We're going to bring you more of those journeys and share them with you to really illustrate and show you that that can be you too. You absolutely deserve that. And if you need that, then continue listening to the women that we're bringing you. You can still have happiness and joy, even in spite of physical pain. If that's you, definitely stay tuned because we're about to get into this episode with April Hagen.
Let's let's jump straight in. Tell us, who was April before her journey to motherhood?
I was highly into my fitness. I was an ex-netballer and I loved doing high-intensity exercise like CrossFit. I was traveling the world. I lived in London for 6 years. I just had this really amazing, vibrant life. I had tons of friends and yeah, it's just very easygoing, carefree. Yeah, I just loved life.
It sounds like you had a real zest for it, like a go-getter.
I did, but also a real, like, I think your 20s, you're so confused, but you don't know it, you know, you're just out there and you're doing all this stuff and you're looking for the things that make you happy. So yes, I was just trying everything and anything I could to, you know, experience life and figure out who I was. But yeah, for the most part, I had a really full and happy life.
Amazing. And then at some point during all of that lovely experience, you obviously met someone, I'm assuming, and decided that you wanted to become a mama. Tell us a bit more about that.
So my entry into motherhood wasn't planned. I was, as I mentioned, living in the UK. So I met my husband. We went to the same CrossFit gym. So we were both heavily into fitness. We did get married quite quickly. We'd only known each other for 3 months, which is just madness. But we just knew. We just knew that even if we didn't work out romantically, we respected and loved each other enough to know that things would be okay. And we've been married nine years this year.
Ooh,
so, you know, it's worked out so far. Thank you. So yeah, we got married. And then just after 12 months of being married, I fell pregnant unexpectedly. So yeah, we weren't trying. I was only 25 at the time, so still quite young, still living in London, not really expecting to be a mum at that stage.
Sure, I understand that. So did you end up moving home back to Australia to have the baby?
We did, yes. Yeah. So again, looking back, all of this stuff is so mad. Yeah, at 32 weeks pregnant, so I had the majority of my pregnancy in the UK, living in London, and at 32 weeks pregnant, we moved back to Australia. So of course, we didn't have a house to live in, so we were back living with my parents. Yeah, it was chaotic, but it was great at the same time.
You probably didn't overthink it. It's like when it's your first pregnancy, flying at 32, as long as you're safe, totally fine.
I did not overthink one thing. And hindsight, of course, I wish I did. I would never, ever fly that distance again, 32 weeks pregnant. It was so uncomfortable. Oh. And yeah, but we did it and we made it and we had somewhere safe to live when we got back with my parents. So we definitely had kind of a stable life here once we did get back.
So when you got back home, how did you decide, or was there even a decision to be made on who's going to be your care provider to help birth your baby?
No definitive decision made. No, we visited my GP and yeah, I don't know. There was no, she kind of suggested, I'll refer you to the local hospital. When I got to the local hospital, they asked if I would mind having a student midwife.
Okay.
And I'd heard some really good experiences as student midwives. So I was eager to have that experience. And my student midwife, I must say, was incredible. So I was just cared for by the local hospital.
Yeah, great. And now I have read a little bit about your journey. That's how we were connected, obviously, because the birth that you had planned didn't go to plan. And we're going to talk about that a little bit. So if you are listening right now and it could possibly trigger you for whatever reason, talking about a traumatic experience during childbirth, you can absolutely pause. You can skip forward to the next episode or come back when you feel you could listen to it. So April, are you okay to share with us what your childbirth experience was like?
Absolutely. So I did not have a plan. I think that I was, I guess, and I was almost going to say then too young, but I wasn't too young to know any different. Like I guess I'd had such a chaotic lead up to my birth, traveling so late in my pregnancy and not really having the same care provider the whole way through, that I think by the time I got to my birth, I just hadn't had a chance to really think about how I even wanted it to look. And then I think the other thing that impacted my experience was that my only other experience of childbirth was I was present at my sister's birth of her second, which was, in hindsight, the dream birth.
Okay.
I didn't know that. textbook. I didn't know it at the time, but now I do that. And so I went into my own experience, I guess, with expectations that mine would be the same. And it was very different.
Okay.
So I went overdue. So I was 2 weeks overdue. So there's another element to this, I guess, is that I was due on the 13th of December, 2015.
Okay.
So then 2 weeks overdue from the 13th of December.
Yes, I did this. I just did the math. Oh my God, busy time. Okay.
Yeah. So that leads you obviously into Christmas. So the advice that we were getting at the hospital was, we don't want to induce you Christmas Eve or Christmas Day because we think that that would be dangerous leading into public holidays and kind of skeleton staff not having access to the resources that we normally would.
Sure.
So, of course, we were fine with that advice. We didn't think to question it. We just said, okay, if that's the best option. So I had a very long induction process when they did start it. So okay. I had the Cervidil, which is the tape. I mean, it's been such a long time now that I've even spoken about this. But then I did also have a balloon catheter. So, you know, that's when they insert, I guess, two balloons, one on either side of the cervix, and they manually fill those balloons to open your cervix. That happened to me on Christmas Day. So I was...
So even though they said they don't want to do it Christmas Eve and Christmas Day because of skeleton stuff, they were still doing it on Christmas Day?
Yeah. So they kind of did these tiny little steps. They didn't want to start the drip until
after the public holidays.
Yeah. So then they did do these kind of little steps to try and ripen my cervix, as they say. And so, yeah, Christmas Day, I was in there really early and they were doing this balloon catheter to my cervix. So I got home from the hospital about midday on Christmas Day, and I was actually in a lot of pain at that point. In a lot of ways, I found that induction process with the balloon catheter very traumatic. Nobody prepared me for that.
Was the balloon, was what they were doing and filling it with air, was that painful itself, or was there pain elsewhere?
No, that was painful in itself.
In the canal. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so I guess like nobody, I did not even know it was a thing. Nobody had told me they could do these things. So I'm just in like a normal hospital room and there's maybe like five or six people in there and they're just up in my business putting this thing in. Nobody said this could be really painful. I remember kind of then being in this position of thinking, whoa, wait, hang on a second. How is this happening? I'm in so much pain. And yeah, so that was Christmas Day. And anyway, they ended up sending me home with this thing inside me.
Yes.
And I was to return the next day, which would be Boxing Day. So when I returned on Boxing Day, that's when they started the drip. We got everything going, and that happened really fast. As I hear quite a lot, an induction can get things moving really quickly, sometimes too quickly. And the rest from there is like a bit of a blur, as most labors are, I guess. The pain, the vomiting, and just...
The vomiting, April.
Yeah.
No one. It's in no pregnancy book. I've never seen that women can vomit in childbirth.
Yeah.
While you were vomiting, were you still having this balloon inside your vagina?
No. So that had come out at that point. So once they started the drip, they'd taken the balloon catheter out.
Okay.
And so that was kind of just, I guess, then what you would call just normal labor, but I had the drip in. And it was very, very intense from very early on.
Sure.
So, I mean, there's a lot of little parts to this, I guess, that aren't little, but because there's so many of them, I guess it's, I want to try and pick out the parts that were the most significant. But there's so many things in here. And I think that when women do recount their birth, they might feel the same. It's like, there's so many things I'm not even, that were traumatic throughout that I'm not even talking about because they weren't the big things, but there's so many of them.
I hear you.
Yeah. So I guess fast forward all the little things. It was about kind of, so this is Boxing Day. And so by the time nighttime came, so I started pushing at around 10:30 at night.
Yep.
I then proceeded to push for about 2 hours. My memory is that with every failed push, I guess, I could kind of see the faces of people around me. I wasn't getting any like positive feedback.
Yeah.
More and more people would start coming into the room and I was like, what's going on? Why don't I have a baby yet? And eventually they said to me, look, we don't think you're making any progress. We would like to use forceps.
Okay.
And I said, my main memory is that I said, is there an increased risk of tearing? Because I'd heard that somewhere, obviously.
Yes, so of course.
Said, is there an increased risk in tearing? And she said, I'll do the best I can.
Okay.
I knew what they were. I knew the concept of them.
Yeah. The salad looking things. I think that's all we remember them as, right?
Yeah. So I didn't know really what I was agreeing to. Because I'd never done any research. I'd never even typed into Google forceps, dangers of forceps, and reasons for using forceps. Nothing.
Yeah. Yep. I understand.
And so my memory from this part is just laying there. Thankfully, I'd had an epidural. So I didn't feel a lot of what was happening.
Sure.
I guess my recount of this part is a secondhand experience from my husband and my sister who was in the room. Mm. And they say that the doctor actually couldn't get a lock on my son's head.
Okay.
So it was in, it was out, it was in, it was
the
out.
The forceps or the head? The forceps.
The forceps. So lots of attempts to try and get a lock on the baby's head. And eventually they had to call in a more senior doctor to get a lock.
Yep.
They also, at that point, before they actually started pulling, they did an ultrasound to scan the position of my baby. So all throughout my pregnancy, my baby had been in the posterior position. And so I now know that when a baby's in a posterior position, forceps is not the best option. And so they did an ultrasound and they found for the first time in my entire pregnancy that the baby was now anterior. Oh.
He turned.
Yeah. Well, according to them, he had turned.
Oh, okay. This is going to get, okay.
Yeah. So he was now anterior. And we're like, oh, that's weird. Been posterior the entire pregnancy and now he's changed. But okay, let's proceed.
You can't see
in
there. You don't know.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, I didn't know to question anything. So I just trusted everything that was happening.
Yes.
They then pulled the baby out. And of course, he was face up. And so.
Oh, he was still posterior.
Still posterior. So.
Wow.
The doctor, I remember saying, oh, he surprised us. Or, yeah, because we knew he was a boy. So he said, or she said, oh, he surprised us. That's a weird thing to say. Like, I'm laying there,
surprise, I've got 10 arms.
What's the surprise? Like, I don't know what the surprise is. And again, thankfully, I could not feel any of this. However, in the process of pulling him out, I had a very severe tear, which they diagnosed as a 3A on the table.
Maybe just for our listeners, just give a little bit more information about what that grade and letter means, if you can. I don't even know if anyone's told you since, but what does it kind of mean to you?
So, look, my very basic understanding of that is that there are three levels. So I don't even know what a one is, but I know that a three is into, I guess, the sphincter. Mm-hmm. And so a 3A is just into the outside of the sphincter. And then it goes to a B, which is a little bit further, and a C, which is, I guess, all the way through.
Yep.
Yeah. So I was diagnosed with a 3A on the table and they said that they were going to try and repair me just, I don't know, in theater, know what do you call it, on the, in the delivery suite.
Like where you were, like they weren't going
just
to take
where I
you.
Was. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Okay.
But I then began to hemorrhage. So I was having quite a severe bleed. And so I held my son who is healthy. And for that, I'm so thankful. However, I held him for, I want to say 30 seconds and then he was taken. And isn't it funny how it can be 6 years now that I've worked hard to get through this and it still chokes me up. That moment where he's taken away still gets me every time.
I can see so, and April, by all means, we can take a break if you need. We can come back. I can see it in you and I don't want to cause you any more pain. In what you live with. So
Thank you for that. But I am okay to continue.
Okay.
They took him, and my understanding of what happened there is that they asked my husband to take his shirt off, and my husband had skin to skin. I was then told that I had to go to surgery. So I had to go to surgery to fix my 3A tear in surgery and to, I guess, you know, stop the bleeding and the hemorrhage. So I was pretty hysterical at that point. I had never had a surgery. I just had a baby and was being separated from him. Mm. I was really, really scared. No point during the preparation for my birth had anybody mentioned that I firstly could tear so badly and that I could end up needing a surgery. I had no idea. So I was really, really scared.
Yeah, of course.
So scared that they had to sedate me because I was very, very emotional. So I do kind of remember the surgery. I remember kind of falling asleep, waking up and thinking, what is happening? Who are all these people?
Where am I?
Yeah. Where am I? Then once I got back to the ward, it was maybe like 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. So very, very early in the morning on the 27th of December.
Yep.
My husband was there to me, it feels like 10 minutes. It feels like he was there and he was like, look at our baby. Isn't he beautiful? And I was like, yep.
Uh-huh. What baby? Yep. I haven't met him yet. What baby are you talking about?
Yeah. So, and then the nurses came around and said pretty swiftly, you have to leave.
To your husband.
To my husband. It was 2 o'clock in the morning on a maternity ward and he had to leave because he was a male and this was not the place for him and he had to leave. And so I was like, please don't leave me. Really, again, quite scared. I said to the nurses, am I going to be in pain? Like, I've just had surgery. Do I need painkillers? What's going to happen? And they said, no, you'll be fine. Like, you've had lots of pain relief from the surgery. You'll be totally fine.
Okay.
So my husband left, had this little baby next to me who I think I had held him at that stage, but it was a very kind of vacant zombie kind of hold. I was like, okay, great. Like, baby, can we please just put him back? Because I'm, you know, so overwhelmed right now.
And coming out
exactly,
of anesthetic.
Yeah. So I think they even tried to get me to breastfeed. I believe there's a picture of me with a boob out trying to breastfeed, but I was not there emotionally. I was, you know, well gone by that point. And so the baby was next to me. And then I think pretty quickly after my husband was sent home, I started experiencing intense pain. Like, it will never leave me, the pain that I felt laying there by myself in the hospital room with this tiny baby next to me who I couldn't reach out to, I couldn't pick up. I don't remember him crying or anything, but I remember feeling so helpless. I'd just become a mother and I was in agony. I was confused. I was alone. So I was crying, yelling out. Like, I was in a shared ward with 4 other women. I remember yelling, please help me. Please help me. Someone help me.
Oh, April.
And so when the nurses came, they said there weren't any doctors around to prescribe me any pain medication because it was the 27th of December. So again, there was, I guess, skeleton staff. All the doctors were having their holidays. And so I laid there, it feels like for a while, in a lot of pain. They were kind of giving me a sponge bath, seeing if it might help, but it didn't, of
course. Trying to distract you. Do you know how infuriating that is to hear that? Like, it's infuriating. You can't even get pain medication. Wow.
Yeah. So eventually it came. I don't know what time it was, but it felt like a really long time.
Yeah.
So they ended up giving me some morphine, which knocked me out enough to sleep. But of course, then they'd taken my baby away again for the second time because I was unable to care for him. So they took him away. And then my husband came back. I actually remember I must have only had a couple of hours sleep. So I remember waking up, having my phone nearby and texting him furiously saying, please come back, please come back. Mm. And that actually became an issue in our marriage later on because I felt like even though it wasn't his fault, he abandoned me. He left me there against, I guess, his, you know, he knew that it had been a really rough time. He knew the rules were go home, but I was like, but you left me, even though you knew that things weren't right. But anyway, we've worked through that now and we're okay. But mm-hmm. that was something we had to work through. So I was texting him furiously, please come back, please come back. And so he came back at about 7.
Yep.
And yeah, I was just a shell of a person, I think, after the couple of days leading up to, and then the 24 hours plus of pain and isolation that I felt following that. I was looking back a shell of a woman that day when I woke up, and a shell for a few years after that as well.
Right. So at some point that hospital said to you, okay, it's time to go home. What did that look like? Did they come and tell you about your tear, about the surgery, about the repair, about where you were at, and then how to care for you when you went home?
Actually, the night that I had surgery, the doctor came and saw me. I was in a very bad state of mind when that doctor came to explain to me what happened. And so, yes, I got an explanation, but I wasn't in the right frame of mind to receive the information.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I don't really remember what she said. What I remember is her feeling bad for me. I remember her coming to my bedside and apologizing and saying, I'm so sorry that this happened the way it did.
Yeah.
And so I believe that there was a number of other moments where doctors came and explained things to us, but I have no memory of that at all. Mm. I don't have a memory, but I think that my husband would remember that. Kind of few days a little bit differently than I do.
Yep.
And then we went home. So today, anyone who's had a baby in, I guess, a shared ward in a public hospital knows that is no place to recover from anything.
Yeah.
You are in a room full of, you know, you've got 4 other mothers, maybe more depending on the hospital. There's babies crying and just stuff going on. It's chaos. So I wasn't getting any sleep. I wasn't recovering. I did have to have 2 blood transfusions in the couple of days after. Okay. So much blood. I kept passing out every time I tried to get up.
Oh, that's not good if you're going to try and hold a baby, is it?
Exactly. Yeah. So in the hospital, I missed things like my son, like Leo's first bath. I didn't see that. I didn't care to change a nappy. I didn't have the energy to give him a kiss on the head. I remember holding my son like this after all the visitors had left, holding him and going, saying to my husband, can you take him back, please? And he said, why? What's wrong? And I didn't have the vocabulary then to say, I'm traumatized and I need a break. I just said, I just don't want him anymore. Mm. And that set the tone for me and my relationship with my baby for a few years after that as well. This kind of, I love you, but I can't care for you. please take him back.
Yeah, you hear that, and you've probably heard it more commonly now after being so brave to share your story, that women probably say, I was exactly the same. And then you've had this shame to even say that, because as a mum, you're meant to love and adore this baby, and if you don't have that instant connection, there is this judgment generally passed on by other women and ourselves.
I really felt this. I didn't know what birth trauma was. I didn't know you could be traumatized from birth trauma. I didn't have any other, apart from my sister, I didn't really know any other mothers. I was the first of my friends to have a baby.
Yes.
I'd never considered the possibility that what I was experiencing happens to other women. I thought that I was unique. I now know that it is more common than it should be, that these traumatic experiences happen. But yeah, I felt very, very alone, and that I couldn't say the things that I was feeling because they were too scary.
And afterwards, when you had arrived home where you live, did they have like a community group that put you into a new mother's group with other babies and mums?
I did have a mother's group. Yes. Yes, I did have a mother's group.
Did they share their birthing stories, you know, in group time?
Yes. So in a group of, I think there was maybe 8 or 9 of us, there was 2 of us who'd had a birth trauma. Okay. The other woman never attended any in-person group settings because she also had some severe injuries that she was dealing with. So whilst I knew there was another mother who had suffered, I'd never met her and I'd never had the opportunity to swap stories.
Okay. And you just touched on it then. You said another mum that had injuries. I'm assuming that your repair surgery didn't mean that April, the 25-year-old running around London, was back all of a sudden. Are you able to give us some information about what the consequences of that event to you and your body?
Absolutely. So we later found out after we requested documents that I actually had a 3C tear, so right through the anal sphincter. It was repaired, we later learnt, quite well in surgery. However, I want to say 2 to 3 months post birth, and I mean, like, my recovery from this birth was awful. I was torn from front to back. It was painful. I couldn't stand. I was bleeding. I had stitches everywhere. Like, the first 3 months was awful, painful. And I had a newborn.
And let me guess, you couldn't even sit down.
Couldn't sit down. The only place that I felt comfort was like totally laying on my back. But I would have the first 2 to 3 months, I would have flashbacks of the birth. I had nightmares of Leo being taken away from me. Yeah. And all the while, I didn't understand what was happening to my body. So I had things like, you know, a salt bath. I would sit in like 2 centimeters of salt water every night to try and heal myself. But that's just something I like made up, or maybe I found it on Google. No doctor or nurse told me to do that. That was like me thinking, okay, well, I'm torn there. Like, how do I fix this?
So how do you heal? Yeah.
How do I heal it? So that's what I did. I was quite lucky in that I had my parents nearby. And so my mum was making me very nutritious meals and making sure that I had everything I need. I had not just my husband there to help care for the baby, but also my two parents. So my baby, thankfully, despite me not being physically and emotionally available, had three other carers available to him. So
that's beautiful.
For that, I'm so thankful. And he's very close with my parents to this day, as you can imagine. I guess 2 or 3 months after, so once all my wounds had healed, I started to notice a significant bulge in my vagina. I felt like there was always something in there, like a tampon or something. Like, what is that? That's so weird. I didn't know what a prolapse was. I had no idea. Never heard the word before in my life.
Where did you turn to when you noticed this bulge?
Yeah, so I was having regular check-ins with the hospital at this point. So I was seeing a physio. I don't think she was a specific women's health physio, but I was referred to the hospital's physio, who was giving me exercises to do, but never doing kind of any checks to make sure I was doing them right. So I would go in and she'd say, squeeze, release, squeeze. And I'd be like, oh, I think I'm doing it. And she'd be like, oh yeah, it sounds like you are. Cool. Well done. I knew things weren't right, but the doctors kept saying, you'll recover. It's early days. Please don't worry. You can go back to exercise. You can, you know, you're magically just okay now once you pass that 6 week check mark.
6 week mark.
The 6 week check. So I did. I kind of slowly started to try and exercise again, but I was like, oh, this doesn't feel right. Why doesn't this feel right? And then on we took my son back to the UK to visit family. He was 6 months old. He was 4 months old. So pretty quickly afterwards. But I had kind of what I thought physically recovered. And then on that trip to the UK, I properly prolapsed. So what I now believe is I properly prolapsed. So I had a significant drop in my bladder, bowel, and uterus, which I could physically feel. I was like, okay, something is wrong now. And this is going to be bad. And so got back to Australia and I went back to the hospital one more time. And I said, something is wrong and I need answers. And the answer I got was, you know, we asked to see the head of obstetrics and we went the whole hog. We said, give us answers. We've had enough. And they said, oh yeah, sorry. You'll just have to live like this now. And maybe that's not the exact words, but that's the message I
generally
got, right?
Yeah, that's what they said, basically.
Yeah.
And I was like, have a nice day.
Yeah. I'd gone the last 6 months thinking this is going to get better. This is normal. Don't worry, you'll be okay. And then in that moment, that sitting there and they said, oh yeah, sorry, like this is permanent and you'll just have to learn to live like this. The doctor said to me, you can find ways around living with prolapse. She said, you might just have to fold the washing sitting down.
Clearly, April, that doctor has never had a pelvic organ prolapse, let alone a three-compartment pelvic organ prolapse in her underpants. Because sit down and fold the washing, but guess what? You're sitting on it. You're sitting on your prolapse. My gosh.
Exactly. From there, it was a very quick decline in my mental health. I could feel it coming, and I would say to my husband, I don't just not feel physically not right. I feel mentally like things are becoming messy. I'm unraveling. I don't know what to do. So
you're just saying that was really intelligent of you to have that insight to even say that to him. I don't know the women you've spoken to, but we find a lot of women are already rocking in the corner before they've even identified that something's wrong. So
yeah,
that must have been hard for you both, I can imagine.
It was hard because it was awful, but it was hard because nobody knew what to do. I was saying it and I was verbalizing it and I knew that things were coming unstuck, but nobody knew what to do.
The next step.
We went to my GP and we kind of said how I was feeling, and she suggested antidepressants, which was like, that's fine. I think I started them, but it took 2 weeks for me to go from a bit nervous or what's happening to totally gone. Like, could not get up off the floor crying. My mind had gone from okay to very, very not okay in the matter of 2 weeks. So scary. Really scary, really, really scary stuff. At that point, it was pretty clear I needed hospitalization. Again, nobody knew though. Nobody knew what to do. Nobody knew that mums and bubs units were a thing. Nobody knew. I was admitted to just a normal, like just a general psych ward in Newcastle, but I couldn't have Leo there with me. So at first we thought that was a great idea. I'd have a break and I could recover. But within a couple of hours of me being dropped off, I was hysterical. And they just kept sedating me. Anytime that I would express any kind of emotion, they would just sedate me straight away. So I managed to text my husband just before the next sedation kicked in. And I said, get me out of here now. This is not the right place. And I found a link to another website who did mums and bubs psychiatric admissions somehow.
Was that St. John of God?
Yes, St. John of God.
Yeah, yes. I've been there.
So
too.
I think I actually found them through the Panda website. So I went onto the Panda website and I found the link to St. John of God, and I sent that to my husband and I said, this is what we need. This is what I need. Can you please come and get me out of here? And he got me out the very next day. Good. And yeah, so I was then home for a couple of days and then I was admitted to St. John of God. It's really interesting to reflect back on. I've told my story a lot of times, but I guess not in this way, not in its whole entirety, always little pieces, but never the whole thing. So it's really interesting journey to look back on.
It's a huge journey. It really is. In 2015, you said Leo was born, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
That was my girl, Elsie, too. October 2015.
Really? No.
Was there something in the water that year or what?
Wow. That is crazy. Wow.
Yeah. And it was a busy time because they said hospital wards in October are flat out because parents get funky in Christmas, New Year. Nine months later, September and October is really busy. So you've been in the psych ward. It's not a psych ward. It's a mums and bubs mental health support unit. I think I need to get that right because it's very different to a psych ward. They have psych wards there. When I went into St. John of God, I looked at those and thinking I was in the wrong place. I'm like, I'm not that bad. And I couldn't see myself until you kind of walk down that security corridor and you walk into the mums and bubs and you're like, oh, here's my people. Yeah, I'm okay.
Oh my gosh, yes. I totally relate to that. It was like, whoa, where am I? And then the doors open. It's just this like beautiful like lounge, like it's carpeted. And I instantly felt safe when I walked into St. John of God. Yeah.
isn't it? Yeah. I feel like we need to say that because it's not a scary process for mums who are listening, thinking that they might need something like this. Although searching your bags for contraband, that freaked me out a bit because I was like, yeah. What type of contraband do you think I'm bringing in? Like, is it, ain't you allowed to have lollies?
Yeah.
But then this is all part of your learning, isn't it? That some mothers are so unwell, there might be drug and alcohol as part of the issue. I don't know. But yeah. So after your stay there and you had returned home, you've got this prolapse. You've been told there's nothing you can do, but I have a feeling, April, that wasn't the end of the story for you. Yeah, I don't see you just kind of going, okay, whatever.
Yeah. Look, it's, again, it was a long process of doing my own research. I linked up with a beautiful, very talented private women's health physio in Sydney, who I paid for out of pocket. And I'm lucky that I was able to do that. So she helped me understand more about my injury and gave me permission to get off Google and listen to somebody. Listen to somebody who could advise me based on my individual circumstances. So I took a lot of comfort in my appointments with her. I would attend regularly. I'm talking like once a month to begin with. I was having ongoing psychology sessions. I was medicated for a long time as well. However, I never stopped in my quest to learn what had happened to me. Why had it happened? Is this it? Is there more? Is there something I can do to change the trajectory? You know, if you Google these things, what you find isn't very nice. And so my mind was filled with these images of prolapses I'd found on the internet. The internet will quite often tell you, you can't run, you can't lift your baby, you can't, full list of things that you cannot and must not do because you're going to make your prolapse worse. And so I guess over a period of years, some days were good, some days were bad, I developed my own set of strategies based on what I'd researched to manage my own prolapse. Now, the reason I say my own set of strategies is because I truly believe that every woman experiences prolapse in a different way. And so I took comfort in the group settings of, you know, meeting other women that had prolapse and realizing that I wasn't alone and that this worked for this woman and this worked for this woman. But I didn't want to, I'm going to use the word doom. I'm going to say I didn't want to buy into the future that was maybe a reality for some women because it didn't have to be my reality. Yes, I've got a prolapse. Does that mean that I have to be incontinent in my 60s? Does that mean that I can't do the exercise that I want to do? No. Does it look different? Yes.
Adapting.
And that's okay. Adapting, but also, and again, it maybe took me a few years to learn this too, but like testing myself little by little. If somebody says I can't do something, okay, I heard you and I listen, but I'm going to test that for myself. And I'm not saying to go out and do anything crazy, like don't be, you know, CrossFit lifting crazy amounts up over your head. I'm talking with the help of my physio.
Yes, you did. You weren't rogue. You were just navigating this space for you and your body. I hear you. Yeah. I understand.
Yeah. And so even to this day, I'm still doing that. I've just started a new type of gym class, which is a combination of rowing and Pilates. So the rowing side of things is on the daring side I'm like, oh, is that okay? But so far it's okay. And so that for me is enough evidence that that is okay for me. And so I definitely encourage women to explore, be cautious, but explore and don't limit yourself. Just because you have this injury, it does not mean you are destined for a certain life. You can make this whatever you want it to be. Don't feel like life is over because it's really not.
And it's when people paint that picture, who we respect and trust in the medical profession and say, oh, well, that's it. Through your journey, were you offered things like pessaries and things like that?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Were they successful for you to be able to exercise or function?
Yes. So I tried various pessaries, as most people do when they start on this journey. Yes. I found the most success with a cube pessary, which I did wear on and off over the years, but for the most part, I found it quite pain, quite having something inside me as I show up to the gym. I'm like, oh, is it in there? Is it not? Do I need to run to the loo to check? Like, it was just, awkward, uncomfortable. So awkward. And so for me, on my personal journey, I'm now at a point where I don't use a pessary despite my injuries.
Yep.
Doesn't mean I won't in the future, but I find the process of putting it in and think it, like, I don't want to think about my prolapse all day long. And using a pessary for me makes me think about it all day. Like, no, my life is more than a pessary and a prolapse. And if I can live it, I'm 33 now. So if I can live it for however many years now without it, then I'm going to do that because I want to enjoy my life. I want to make the most of every day.
Let's talk a bit about your life now, because I think this is how we initially were connected, that my friend shared with me. So you have gone on and created a life for you that it suits you. And I'm assuming, correct me if I'm wrong, that you've created a profession where you can still function because your brain is all still 100%, even if your prolapse physically might be a bit of a resistance, is not the word I mean, but a little bit of a hurdle. Right. Mm-hmm. So you might not be able to walk long distances or stand. So then you've gone out and created a career and a life path that suits that, being sedentary or sitting at a desk for longer periods of time, right? To manage.
I've never thought of it in that way, but you're absolutely right. I created this based on what I feel like my body was able to handle. So my background is in interior design. I'm not a designer, but I worked kind of in the project management side of things. So helping interior designers deliver their projects.
Okay.
A lot of that was on site, moving furniture, unwrapping boxes, not something that, and look, if anybody who's working in the interior design sector is listening, just because I chose not to do that does not mean you cannot do that if there are ways to manage your symptoms around working in that industry.
It's fair to say too, but generally speaking, heavy lifting, moving constantly all day, standing, walking is not so prolapse friendly for your symptoms and your pain.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So I would be on site and honestly, I swear to you, there were points where I was like, do I invest in like one of those little camping stools? You know, the little ones that fold up like into a little, it's a little triangle. Do I have to take one of those to site with me? Because this was kind of in the early days too, where I was still trying to figure out what life with prolapse looks like for me. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I guess when the opportunity came to start my own business, I did. And so I've combined my love of interior design with my love and education in marketing to create May June Creative, which is a social media marketing company. It was something that I chose for myself based on my prior life experiences. You're right.
And I love that. And I know we said this offline because you're April and you made May June from someone who's had a little taste of UX design. I absolutely love that because it's so creative. And then I think to you having that creative outlet now also helps deal with trauma because you're constantly moving forward on your journey, constantly finding new goals. Yeah. And you've probably understated it. Like, your website is freaking amazing. So engaging and so drawn to it. So you can see the passion behind what you're doing. And I think ultimately everyone who is listening right now, April is testament that you can do anything. So at the same time, you've had this young little Leo around as well while starting this online business. I'm pretty sure that it started small and eventually it's grown into the amazing that it is today, right?
Yeah. I guess there's two other things that I probably should mention. I did have a second baby. Yeah. So I now have little Mickey who's just about to turn two.
Yay.
And that was not a decision I made lightly. By that stage had done all my research and I knew that it was a risk, things could get worse. Mm-hmm. I had a planned Caesar. I had a very, I guess, controlled environment.
You had choices because you knew the information. Yeah, which is very different.
So, mind you, I did have her during COVID. So that was a whole nother experience, but like still beautiful in comparison. Amazing. The most beautiful experience. Healing, but also sad at the same time. Healing because I had the experience I missed out on, but then I was so sad for Leo. I was sad for him and I, that there was big chunks missing from that experience for us. So but yeah, for the most part, it was a really good experience. And then, oh, there was one other thing I wanted to tell you.
It'll come to you. Just butt in, because I just want to say that that is a very common question asked of me as well. Yeah. Like, so if you've had prolapse with your first baby, how did you go to have another one? So number one, how do you even have sex? Number two, how did you birth with prolapse? So this is information, April, that's missing. It's missing from our pregnancy education. It's missing from our antenatal classes. It's just... Because people think, oh, well, it's not that common. But look at you and me sitting here today, almost identical stories. How can that not start to be common? I have a question for you. At any point, were you able to let the hospital know that this has happened to you after, including like the prolapse, I mean?
So the advice I was given was to seek a formal mediation process with the hospital. But I was so traumatized by the time that we realized that was an option that we went straight to court action. So we, we took court action against the hospital, and that was finalized February 2019. So we did settle for a figure with the hospital as well. That in itself was a journey. I was told by many family members not to do that because it was going to be more trauma. Mm-hmm. However, I'm very glad that I did. In a lot of ways, like, money is not going to bring back my health, but it was the only option I had. And I'm really glad that I took that choice. I didn't have many choices over the course of the experience, but that I did have a choice on. And I'm really glad that I did it.
Because ultimately it was part of your resolve from trauma, wasn't it? Because you had closure. And
And look, I do have to say that I didn't have closure on the event until the court case was settled. So whilst I may have been able to mentally move on quicker, it was very present in my life while ever that court case was in process. I think we settled that, must have been like three and a half years after the birth. No, sorry, it would have been 4 years after the birth. So it's a long time
sitting on holding your shoulder.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
We went down the same path. This is why I'm like, I can't stop this. In the end, ultimately, it came down to, because I'm no expert when it comes to law, so when they ended up getting a barrister from Sydney to come down to where we live to take over a number of cases from our hospital, all around the same time, very similar trauma, she said, well, potentially they could say that you had an aversion to C-sections because in your birthing plan it says no C-sections or natural birth. And I was like, but I didn't fill that out. That was pre-filled. That was given to me by Calm Birth. I just signed it. I knew no different, right?
Yeah.
And they're like, well, they could use it against you. So there's a risk. There's a risk that you could lose. And if you lose, they will take your house. And I was like, well, as in, because we don't have spare cash to pay their expenses. So I was like, okay, so I'm going to go through all of this, put my family through this, and then I could potentially make my children homeless.
Oh, God.
No. I'm not that much of a risk taker. And like you, an amount of money definitely was not ever the aim. All I wanted, April, was an apology. I wanted the hospital to stop telling me that what happened to me was normal and that I was going to be okay. Because it's not true. And I wanted it to not happen to any other women, especially in that particular hospital. And the barrister said to me, none of those things are going to happen. They're just going to throw some money at you to go away and be quiet and never talk about it again. And I was like, well, that's not for me. And so I found my resolve doing this instead, writing a book and talking about it, because I feel you and I right now, someone will listen to this at some point. I'm talking someone who's looking after all of our policies that mm-hmm. got us in this situation. And they may just decide, hey, you know what? We probably should have a look at this, because while economically it's going to cost us money to look at prevention, these women are paying so badly with their life, their career, not able to return to your job, to my job as a teacher. And it's going to be more expensive.
Yeah.
In the long run, right?
Yeah. There's so many of us. It's shocking how Once I started telling my story and being really open about what happened, I was horrified at the people that came forward. My DMs would be full of people. So at first I just started sharing my story on Instagram, and just random people, not random women, but these incredible humans were landing in my inbox saying, oh my God, can you please tell me where do I go for this? And how do I get this information? And so that's what has motivated me to keep telling my story, is because I know it touches people. I know that they're listening, and I know that they need help.
Oh, wow. What a journey. It's really, I just cannot believe the similarities between us. There must be more and more women. This is just a very general question. I do not expect you to have the answer, but throughout the years, have you ever thought of how we could make this better for our girls?
That is a really great question. I guess I have thought about it, and it's doing this. It's speaking openly and honestly. And you know what? Despite advice from my psychologist, I tell my son when I'm in pain, when I'm bleeding every month, and when I can't take him to the park, I tell him it's because mummy has a sore vagina. There is no shame in that. Little boys and little girls need to know and be prepared that these are things that happen in real life. And so I just try to be as honest as I can and hopefully prepare them for what may or may not happen. Hopefully they don't even have to experience it. But for now, the best I can do is be really honest.
And they'll just be better educated either way anyway about their own anatomy, which is amazing.
Yeah.
Now, look, I know I don't want to hold you up anymore because we could just keep talking forever. However, I want to invite you back, because there's an extra part of your journey now that I really have aligned with, and that is giving up alcohol. So if you would like to come back, I would really love to chat with you about that, because I feel like that's in itself is really inspiring for a lot of mums.
I would be thrilled to speak to you about my journey without alcohol. So I would love that.
Let's do it.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much, April. It has been so nice to connect with you. And I feel like, I don't know, now maybe now I feel like how our Brave Mama members feel, because I feel like I see myself in you. And that's such a beautiful feeling. Thank you for opening your heart and being really honest with us.
Thank you for listening. I get as much out of this as I hope other people do by sharing and telling my story. So I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Like I said, just at the end of that conversation there, I too feel so inspired by April's story. I mean, there's so many similarities between us that I think, yes, I feel seen and heard. And so now I kind of feel like I understand what it feels like for those brave mamas who are in our free Facebook group, who feel like, oh, wow, I can see myself in that. It's a really nice feeling. So I hope you get that too. I mean, that's always been our aim. But if that happens for you, imagine what you could do for someone else just simply by sharing a link to the Facebook group, or just telling them that it even exists, telling them that there are resources and places they can go, especially with birth trauma. And we'll put all the links down below in the show notes. This is your time. This is your time to feel good. And I'm actually really looking forward to being able to share with you the conversation with April about taking things out of your life that are not serving you well, like alcohol. I mean, that's a whole nother journey. It's potentially a whole nother podcast. But for now, we want you to feel the best way you can. And if you haven't heard it already, we did hit 10,000 downloads for the podcast, which is a momentous occasion that I'm joyfully celebrating. Normally, I wouldn't say too much. I'm like, oh, that's amazing, because you don't want to sound like a show off. But my God, I want to show the world that what we are doing and how we're achieving it is because of you. And so last week on the quick episodes on the Friday, we announced that for the next 10 days, we are going to support this community by having $10 off the new Tips and Tricks ebook. This book is for you if you want very practical ways on how to live your daily life the best way you can in the easiest way possible. Because I've walked this journey a few steps ahead of you for the last 7 years, constantly looking for new ways, easier ways to do things and to feel happy and to be fulfilled. It's not always easy, but we share that in the book too. All the workarounds, how to prepare meals, how to find fashion that fits you, how to deal with the emotional side of prolapse, how to communicate to people. I think that's been really popular. We've had lots of great feedback. I'm like, oh, so that's how I tell my boss. That's how I can communicate to them what's happening to me. And so, yeah, there's a link in the show notes. For the next 10 days, there's $10 off. You don't even have to worry about any of those promo codes or tricky things. We've just reduced the price and we want you to have a copy of that on your phone, on your iPad, on your computer to use whenever you need it. So go and grab yourself a copy and get the help you deserve. If you've been listening to this podcast for a little while, you've probably worked out that some of us are at more risk of developing pelvic floor problems than others, and especially after giving birth. So the Pelvic Floor First is a special dedicated website to raise awareness of this issue, to refer people for help and support, and also provide you with pelvic floor safe exercises. It's for free. If you'd like to find out more information, you can go to pelvicfloorfirst.org.au. This website is an initiative of the Continence Foundation of Australia. We want to thank the Continence Foundation for bringing you this episode today. And until next time, bye for now. Mama.